Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's a great pleasure for me to go all the way across the ocean and reach out to and have on the first time someone I've wanted to have on the McCullough Report for months now, and that's Dr. Shankara Chetty. Dr. Chetty grew up in South Africa. His family is actually quite famous for running the largest bus firm, 108 buses. They actually ran a huge transportation company in South Africa. He went off to Johannesburg and got his bachelor's degree, ultimately got additional disciplines of study, genetics, microbiology, related specialties. From there, he went on to JSS Medical College in Mysore, India, where he received the MBBS degree. And that's how it's typically done in India. It's different than the United States. So it's a prolonged period of education there, 7 years. He returned to South Africa and did his internship in Durban. And then he sought private practice, general private practice in Port Edward, South Africa. And this is in the far eastern stretches of his province, right on the border with the Eastern Cape. And he has become really a worldwide authority on COVID-19 by experience and by his inferences, his ability to make careful observations and then reduce them to practice in helping people get through the pandemic. And I think more than anybody in the world, Dr. Chetty has been innovative. He's probably dealt with more varied patients of different ethnic origins. And he's also worked with a wider range of medications than I think anybody in the field. Dr. Chetty, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. And myself, been waiting to have a chat for a long while.
Well, I can tell you, it's been a whirlwind. I was so impressed with so many of your presentations, your data there, how you ran your program, including some of the open air shots that we saw. We've been on programs and videos together. We don't have time to go through the entire, what we call Chetty protocol, which has been presented in so many different venues. But we want you to update us because it appears as if South Africa is almost premonitory for us. What's happening in South Africa is going to happen in the United States a few weeks or a few months later. And you're developing a great experience and understanding of the Omicron subvariants. So why don't you take it from there? What do you know about the Omicron subvariants and how has the illness changed over time?
Dr. McCullough, the Omicron variant started in around January this year. We had the initial variant, which was relatively neurotoxic, and we started seeing those kind of neurology. Patients were presenting with burning hands and feet, specific dorsal root problems. So we noticed that the initial illness, the viral phase, was pretty similar to what we'd seen previously. Patients had sore throats, body aches and pains, the usual constitutional symptoms, but they managed to get over that relatively unscathed. There were those patients who progressed into a second phase of this illness that presented more with neuropathies. However, those neuropathies were easily managed using the same modality of immunosuppression and anti-cytokine therapy. And none of them got into any crisis. In South Africa, we have only about 25% vaccination. And so we see patients having robust immunity from natural infection. And as the variants have passed, we've gotten milder and milder cases. We've seen a lot of reinfections of those previously infected with the wild type, beta and delta variant. But these reinfections are very mild and transient and quite easily managed. We're now at a point where we're seeing the BA4 and BA5 variants presenting very much similarly to the initial Omicron variant. There are more gastrointestinal symptoms that we're noticing with this variant, but again, a pretty transient infection, unremarkable. A majority of patients recover without any symptoms or without any sequelae. However, I've noticed that in vaccinated patients, we're starting to see some nuances that are very different from the typical progression we've seen in all the other variants that we've had so far. I've had two vaccinated boosted patients in about 2 or 3 weeks ago that had sudden cardiac arrest in my practice on day three of their illness. And their illness severity was really unremarkable, and the cardiac arrest that they went into were not really, there were absolutely no pre-existing symptoms for that. Both of them were not hypertensive, both had no real comorbidities to speak of, and their illness wasn't that severe to warrant that kind of event taking place. We managed to resus them. And from that point on, I knew that with vaccinated patients, I'm going to see a different picture. So I've taken the liberty to do biomarkers on all my vaccinated patients, especially those double vaxxed or double vaxxed and boosted, very early on in their illness. I'm no more waiting for the second week to look for any deterioration. And I found about one in every three of them to have very high CRPs, interleukin 6s and D-dimers by about the second or third day of illness already. However, those with just raised interleukins and CRPs seem to recover uneventfully with simple symptomatic treatment. There are those that have a concomitant rise in their D-dimers, and those are the ones that seem to be getting into trouble with clotting events, things like that. So I think we need to start monitoring these patients a lot earlier. What drew my attention to this, Dr. McCullough, was that there was a comparative study done with Portugal, where they have a very high vaccination rate, and they are afflicted by the same variant that South Africa has. And what we noticed in Portugal is that they have a very high death rate, very, very much similar to the second wave of the pandemic. Whereas in South Africa, there's not much death to speak of with the BA4, BA5 variant. So I knew that vaccines are seeming to cause a problem. And I watch the vaccinated patients a lot more closely than I care about the unvaccinated. And we're noticing these nuances. I've got to find a way to risk stratify the different patients. And I think the biomarkers early in vaccinated patients has been something vitally important in determining who's at risk of having the disease progress rapidly and ending up with severe consequences. So I'm not too sure why this sudden increase in IL-6 and D-dimers early on in these vaccinated patients, but I'm suspicious that we're having some form of antibody-dependent enhancement or some sort of priming that has occurred that has allowed the illness to progress far more rapidly than it did previously, and it does in unvaccinated patients.
But could it be not so much viral, if you will, in terms of viral replication, or could it just be quantitatively exposure to the spike protein? So as people are vaccinated, there's exposure to the messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA, which is prolonged. We have data from Stanford in the United States where the messenger RNA is found in lymph nodes months later. But the spike protein now, several studies have shown that it's in the body for over a year. So this progressive spike protein loading, do you think that is playing a role? Then you get the infection no matter what subvariant we have. And now we just have another acute loading of spike protein that's precipitating microthrombosis, inciting cytokine secretion, et cetera. Do you think that's possible?
Yes, I think that's a distinct possibility. The spike protein, we know of its toxicities. And of course, we know that some people have a hypersensitivity response to spike protein. So I think there are quite a few mechanisms at play, Dr. McCullough. I think those that are at risk of having a reaction to spike protein, anaphylactic or hypersensitivity, on re-exposure to spike protein might be that subset that's having a sudden onset early illness. Quite remarkably, the patients that seem to get into crisis with high biomarkers, when I draw those samples from them, they don't look critically ill. They have a very mild viral illness. So the biomarkers are out of synchronicity with the severity of the illness itself from a virology perspective. And I think that indicates that there's some other mechanisms at play, either immune-mediated or some sort of toxicity to spike protein that's manifesting itself early on. So yes, I think the spike protein and the immune mediation needs to be looked at far more closely.
You know, we published a paper from our hospital early in the pandemic, and it was a woman in her 50s, and she was in the hospital. She was getting progressively more ill and ultimately had a cardiac arrest in our intensive care unit. So we could actually observe the rhythm, and it was a prolonged QT and then torsade de pointe, polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. And the interesting thing is she received no hydroxychloroquine. She received no medicine that could do this. And the cytokine that was most out of range was interleukin 6 when we measured it.
Yes, I've noticed that as well. In the first three waves, the wild type, the beta and the delta variant, you could track a distinct progression. Before the eighth day, you had a rise in CRPs and a slight increase in interleukins, but those were similar to values that you'd find in other viral infections. It just indicated an immune response and a slight inflammation itself. But from the eighth day, there was an exponential rise. And the interleukin 6 was the first to go up. It was followed 2 or 3 days later by CRPs, and then another 2 or 3 days later by the D-dimers. So that showed clearly a hypersensitivity triggering hyperinflammation, triggering hypercoagulation. And that was progressive through the three waves. In the third wave, we noticed the D-dimers rising a lot more, and we noticed far more clotting events. However, with the first Omicron variant, the biomarkers were very unremarkable. There was no rise at all. In patients that showed a return of neuropathic symptoms on the eighth day, the only biomarker that went up was interleukin 6. There was no rise in CRPs or D-dimers. That was the only marker that went up, and it was not really an indicator of severity of the illness itself like it had been in the previous three waves. Now with the BA4 and BA5 variant, I'm seeing CRPs, interleukins going up. But in some patients vaccinated, I'm seeing D-dimers go up with it. And I think those are the ones that are getting into trouble. I've monitored a few patients without medical intervention to see the trend in this. And I found that the CRPs and D-dimers that go up early on tend to rectify themselves spontaneously by the seventh or eighth day. So, but the rise in the interleukin 6 is quite drastic for just a viral illness. The values usually I would encounter in the first, in the viral phase, are usually nothing more than about 50 at the worst. However, in the second phase of the illness, I've had values go up to 400 and 500 at times. In this variant, I've had a patient just last week that I insisted on testing. He wasn't that unwell. He was aware of COVID. He got tested coming in from Zimbabwe. It was his fourth day of illness. He just had mild body aches and pains. He had tested positive for COVID, so I did his values. His CRP was 14, very slightly raised. His D-dimers were normal, but his interleukin 6 was close to 300. I was in two minds about intervening, being early in the illness. So I watched him clinically, and 5 days later, we repeated all his bloods, and everything had returned to normal. So I think that rise in interleukin 6 needs to be looked at more closely and figure out the underlying mechanisms causing that marker to go up. I think it's central to a lot of the pathology we see.
You know, prior to COVID, the leading factor associated with elevations in interleukin 6 was adiposity or obesity, since interleukin 6 is produced by adipocytes, particularly abdominal adipocytes. Have you made the observation that heavier people, more obese people, have higher interleukin 6?
I haven't seen that, Dr. McCullough. With the severity of the illness, I found very little correlation between the second phase of illness and any pre-existing or comorbid conditions. Yes, there was a correlation between outcome, and I think that's expected. Patients that are obese, hypertensive, diabetic, any comorbidity would stall the outcome and give you poorer outcomes. But I don't think they play a role in the initiation of the illness as such. I think there's something else at play that initiates this illness, because I've had patients in the peak of health get into trouble. And I've had patients with comorbidities, previous histories of stents, who had absolutely got into trouble, but got out of it relatively without consequence, being caught early and treated early. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the progression that gets influenced by comorbidity rather than the trigger of the illness itself.
So let me present a paper to you that's just come up on the preprint server system in the last 2 months or so. And the first author is Mura, M-U-R-A, Cameron Mura from University of Virginia in Charlottesville, United States. And the title of the paper is Clinical Evidence for Improved Outcome with Histamine Antagonists and Aspirin in 22,516 COVID-19 patients. And they analyzed outcomes with treatment with histamine 1 receptor antagonist, loratadine, cetirizine, and the histamine 2 receptor antagonist, famotidine. And what they report here, which is, and they use a good case matching comparative outcomes analysis. And again, it's a large sample. So these are outpatients who receive these as part of the doctor's, you know, attempting to help them in practice. Those who received the best out of all the groups was those who received famotidine and aspirin. They had a 45% reduction in the risk for getting worse, requiring respiratory support, being hospitalized, or death. And this is a very large sample size and not a randomized trial, but boy, is as good as you can do. What's your reaction to that? Do you think that's, is that?
I think it's relevant information. With the work that I've been doing, we all knew about the steroids and the ability of steroids to suppress the progression of the illness post eighth day. And that was the first tool I used in the pandemic in the first wave. And it took about 2 or 3 days to see good benefit, with about a week to resolution of symptoms, even in the most severe of patients. And of course, I had to go to higher and higher doses if I wasn't getting clinical benefit. But my attention was drawn to this being some sort of immune hypersensitivity or hyperreactivity. So the very next, I think about when I saw the fifth patient present in that way, I added an antihistamine. And the antihistamine of choice for myself was promethazine, simply because of its broad, diverse action. Being anticholinergic, antimuscarinic, it has sedation, anxiolytic properties. It's antiemetic. It's used in the treatment of dystonia. So it had a broad range or ambit to its ability. And in the first patient that I treated with promethazine, I saw a remarkable recovery. She was, within a few hours, her oxygen saturation recovered from 80% on day 8. By day 9, she was up and about like nothing had happened. And I've had that kind of response to promethazine throughout the pandemic itself. However, with famotidine, Dr. McCullough, in the second wave, we had gut pathology. And I was under the impression that that gut pathology was related to hypersensitivity in the gut itself, an allergic reaction in the gut, because the symptoms were not just related to the gastric symptoms. We had bloating, we had intestinal cramps, diarrhea. So it seemed that the entire GIT was affected. And so I started cetirizine here in South Africa, another H2 blocker. And it was one of the only medications that seemed to work. None of the PPIs, none of the other symptomatic treatments had any benefit. But once I put a patient onto cimetidine, H2 blocker, all the gastric symptoms settled. I think something else that is important, Carlo Brogner in Italy did a study recently where he showed bacteriophage activity with the virus itself, the ability to infect gut bacteria. And it came to the fore with the examination of long COVID patients who seemed to all have some sort of gut upset. And it seemed that patients with previous gut pathology were more prone to developing long COVID. And of course, with the bacteriophage activity and the infection of gut bacteria, there's a production of toxins, which are some neurotoxic, some cytotoxic. And I think that's something that needs to get looked at as well. I think the benefit of antihistamines in the treatment of COVID covers both those mechanisms, both an immune dysregulation and it covers a toxicity. If a patient came to us with a certain toxicity, got bitten by something, we're unaware of what it is, then the modality of treatment would be about the same. A steroid to suppress any overt reaction, and then trying to mop up any mediators with antihistamines, antileukotrienes, and the such. And of course, a platelet activating factor suppressants. So the antihistamines, I think, are vital if instituted early in the way the disease progresses.